You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 25th of April 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from Paris, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson, coming up in this special election edition.
Parce que, dès à présent, je ne suis plus le candidat d'un camp, mais le président de toutes et tous.
A president for all French women and men, but no sooner is Emmanuel Macron handed his mandate for a second term, the criticism, the protest and the challenges begin. We'll have all the reaction from the French presidential election second round, broadcasting live from Bonjour Jacob in Paris's 10th arrondissement. We'll examine the foreign policy consequences of the vote and also ask what France's role in Europe will be in the next 5 years. Plus, I'll be joined around the table by Dana Thomas for a look at the headlines from the world of fashion. That's all coming up on The Globalist. Live from Paris. And a very warm welcome to a very subdued 10th arrondissement in Paris this morning. I'm surrounded by the startings of a brand new day here in Bonjour Jacob. I'm delighted to say we'll be covering the aftermath of the French presidential election for the good part of today here on Monocle 24. Before we start looking at that, though, let's have a look at what else is happening in today's headlines. The US has confirmed that the Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin traveled to Kyiv to meet Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky on Sunday. Myanmar's deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi is expected to face up to 15 years in prison today when a court delivers a verdict in the first corruption cases against her. And an inquiry has begun into what caused a Japanese tour boat to disappear off the nation's coast, killing 11 people. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, France is waking up to a second term under the presidency of Emmanuel Macron. Addressing his victory rally on the Champ de Mars by the Eiffel Tower in Paris, Monsieur Macron accepted the fact that his victory came about, in part at least, because French voters created a blockade against the far-right candidate Marine Le Pen, and he accepted he had promises to fulfil and voices to listen to in his second term. Well, we were down at the Champ de Mars last night at the rally, and as the announcement was made, a cheer did go up, but it was a very subdued and relieved atmosphere, we could say, rather than one of joy. This is what some voters said to us when we asked them how they'd voted.
I voted like blanc. It means I didn't vote neither for Macron nor for Marine Le Pen because it's a good president in economics and liberal, so I totally agree with that. But he's so arrogant with lower classes, and I'm from lower classes. My parents from lower classes, so I don't want to vote for him. Just, you know, to have an opinion like against, not his politics, but his personality, you know, the behavior. I knew that he's going to win, so that's why I didn't take risk.
So tell me, how did you vote and how do you feel tonight about the victory for Emmanuel Macron?
We are super excited. I mean, that's really great news because it was very, very scary to see the Front National at the second round. Yeah, clearly it's not France. We are not like that. France is mixed. It's full of everything. It's youngness, it's future. So we were quite excited to see our country to have that type of ideas, and that's we are just released. That's great. That's a good news.
I think it's a great victory because it was super tight, but finally at the end, 58 is more than what we were expecting. So really, really happy. It means progress. It means Europe. It means a lot of things for us. So super happy.
It's not without its challenges, though, is it? Emmanuel Macron wasn't really liked by everybody.
I don't know. He still finished first at the first round, so he got the majority. He got a lot of challenges during the past 5 years. I think he needs to do more explanation of what he's doing, because I think France is very successful, but I think the rest of the world is seeing that, but not the French people. So, I don't know, maybe we need to ask French people to visit outside of France more often, and they will realize that French is great, actually.
That was the sound of a sort of subdued victory rally at the Champ de Mars yesterday. I'm delighted to say I'm joined around the table here at Bonjour Jacob by Le Monde columnist and former Washington correspondent Gilles Paris. Good morning, Gilles.
Good morning.
Thank you. Bonjour. Thank you so much for coming in on a day when most people would rather, I suspect, stay in bed. Or how big a party was there last night? There didn't seem to be anything in the streets.
Thanks for having me. No, there was no real joy yesterday evening because there were more relief for the people who voted for Emmanuel Macron and a lot of frustration still for the people who backed Marine Le Pen. We saw some strong reaction in her strongholds in Beaumont in the north of France. People were cursing Emmanuel Macron. So no real joys and still a lot of resentment from the people who feel who are left behind and who feel that the system is twisted against their interests.
It does seem like this is a very strange victory. It doesn't feel like a big victory. One thing I do want to ask you is that you were on the editorial floor of Le Monde last night. Practically speaking, what does an Emmanuel Macron victory, what did an Emmanuel Macron victory mean for you at that point, other than an enormous workload had Le Pen got in?
That's the point. We will have some time to recover from the last weeks of campaign. Yesterday was strange because the speech he pronounced after the election was sober, much sober than the one who are supposed to do when you are a clear victor, and he was elected with a strong margin, but a sober speech and a shorter speech. And we know that Emmanuel Macron is used to speak for hours when he had the opportunity. So I feel that we felt that he know that it's not that clear that he won with 58% of the vote, which is big.
And he recognised that in his victory speech. I think there's a line, I think we mentioned it at the beginning of the programme, where he said, "I'm no longer the candidate for one camp. I now want to be a president for all French women and men." How much do we believe that?
They all say that when they are elected.
So I think I'd heard that before somewhere.
It's not brand new, but this time it's really real because to some extent, it's a kind of Potemkin victory in the sense that he has no clear mandate. He was backed at the very last minute by people who don't like him, but they hate more Marine Le Pen. So that was the driving force of many votes, meaning that his platform is not shared by everybody. It is not shared by the majority of people who voted for him, actually.
And there was a huge abstention rate here in France. I think it's 28%. The chat last night was that 18 million people had voted for Emmanuel Macron. 18 million had either spoiled their ballot, not turned up, or did a vote blanc, which we heard from that lady we heard from down at the Emmanuel Macron rally. There were several people who said, "I'm here to cheer the victory of Emmanuel Macron, but I didn't vote for him." And it was an absolute paradox. It really was.
It's the second highest level of abstention in the Fifth Republic, so it's very high, especially because we had a far-right candidate. We would have expected a higher turnout. And we know that the third political trend, which was absent on the runoff, the one built around Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the head of La France Insoumise, which is a left-wing party, but more left than any social democrat movement. So this movement decided not to choose between Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen. And it's not new because they did already that in 5 years ago. But because Marine Le Pen appear to be closer to victory than 5 years ago, it was still a big deal for many people.
So we now have 13 million people who decided that they wanted to take France in the direction of the far right. In Marine Le Pen's figures, it was 41%, wasn't it? So it was lower than the opinion polls had predicted. Nonetheless, that suggests that there is an enormous division in France, which Macron conceded in his victory speech. But what does that division actually look like?
What is interesting is if you look at the map, it's clear that you are the well-off and the left behind, because it's not, of course, the main cities are voting for Emmanuel Macron with big margin, it's clear. The rural areas are for Marine Le Pen. But it's not a pattern, because if you look at Brittany, you've got rural localities who backed Emmanuel Macron. And also you've got small cities in many places in the country who decided to vote for Marine Le Pen. So it's really, there is of course a generational gap between the older voters who decided to vote for Emmanuel Macron and the younger who are more seduced by Marine Le Pen's speech. What I would like to say also is that Marine Le Pen has no mandate neither, because she was the name of a protest vote, and people voted for her because they were voting against Emmanuel Macron, but they were not voting for what she would like to do with France, with European Union, with NATO.
It was something that was against an Emmanuel Macron who many felt was behaving, I think the expression is to behave like Jupiter. And last night, Emmanuel Macron delivered his speech and then went back to the place in Versailles, to it's La Lanterne at Versailles, sort of a lodge that the president enjoys to stay in. It's where he recovered from COVID. And the journalists who went down there were told not to go too near him, because they wanted to, I think it's préserver son intimité. He wanted to have his intimate moment after the election in his house at Versailles. I mean, what does that say about Emmanuel Macron's promises to listen and to engage more with the people? As soon as he wins, off he goes back to Versailles.
Yeah, it's maybe not a good start, but many presidents did much worse after a victory. We remember Nicolas Sarkozy going to a fancy restaurant in the Champs-Élysées. The main point for Emmanuel Macron is maybe not what he did yesterday after the speech, but what he will do in the coming months. In his speech, he promised to create a kind of a new style of governing. He promised to organize decentralized debates on health, on education, which would amount to a political revolution to France, because we know that everything always comes from Paris directly. So it's something which is still vague, but it's maybe his only way out to patch together those different French families.
The patching together is very much an approach that Emmanuel Macron has taken in terms of his political governing of France. He's been criticised of having a lack of political ideology, of adhering to the left or to the right. Yesterday we heard from Joe Devec, who's a fellow with the Foreign Policy Research Institute and author of the German language essay Emmanuel Macron, der Revolutionaire Präsident. And yesterday he joined us around this table at Monocle on Sunday. And this is what he said about the fact that Macron doesn't have that great ideology we can all cling to.
Well, it's a sort of criticism that is made against every French president. And I think with Emmanuel Macron is actually quite untrue. In a sense, he has a vision where the country is. This is sort of, his big European idea. and he's trying to sort of convince the French of this idea of a sovereign Europe and France's place within it. So he has a sort of macro vision of, you know, how to influence the world, how to matter geopolitically, how to defend France's interests, how to tame global capitalism, and this is via the European Union. So there is a strategy there. But the criticism is fair in the sense that he's a complete pragmatist on everything else. And the French really, they're a bit confused about this because they think in terms of ideas and ideology, and they think, is he left wing, is he right wing? And, you know, in reality, if you look at his politics, it looks like the politics of a, you know, a grand coalition in Germany. It's a bit neoliberal, you know, cutting the taxes for, you know, on capital and for the rich to lure in investment, which actually they work. It's social democratic. He increased, you know, the minimum pension and the minimum wage much more than François Hollande did, a socialist. You know, his social policy, there's a bit of reactionary stuff in there. There's a bit of progressive stuff in there. It's all over the place. And that confuses mostly columnists because they're sort of like, hey, you know, like, yeah, it doesn't have like a clear line and there's no clear idea and you don't know where he stands for. But I believe, and this is maybe my Swiss or my German back thing, is that in the end, people really don't give a damn about ideology. Most people care about, you know, is he a good president? Did he manage to do the crisis? Is the economy going well? And, you know, Merkel got elected four times. She was in power for 16 years. And this was even after the end of 16 years. No one knew what Angela Merkel was about. No one knew ideologically if she was left or center or right or whatever. People just trusted her, and this is the big ace Macron has up his sleeve.
That was the fellow with the Foreign Policy Institute, Joseph de Wachter, talking about the fact, Gilles, that Macron's ideology is actually one of being a good manager.
That's the point. He was elected, as I said, as a reformer. He faced difficulties. Notably with the Yellow Jacket insurrection. And then he was able to reinvent himself as a crisis manager. But maybe his biggest success was the fact that during the campaign, nobody mentioned the question of unemployment. Because according to French standard, it's relatively low. It's around 7%. And nobody's paying attention to that. And we have to remember that it was main issues for decades in presidential campaign. So he is a pragmatic, and I totally agree with the point that he had a political North Star, which is his pro-European, I would say, ideology. And what he would like to do, he said almost everything in a famous speech he made in 2017, just after his election in the Sorbonne. And he said that he wanted to build a Europe more cooperative on the fiscal, budgetary issues, and also in defense.
Gilles Paris from Le Monde, thank you so much. You'll be staying with us, Gilles. It's worth noting this month, Le Monde has launched its version in English, for which you'll be writing a website and a daily newspaper with a digest of all its articles. Well worth checking in. You're listening to The Globalist. We're live from Bonjour Jacob, a very pretty cafe in the 10th arrondissement of Paris, live on Monocle 24. I'm delighted to say the tables just got a bit busier because I'm joined by Jasine Weber from the German Marshall Fund from the United States and by Mathilde Schüle. Is it Schüle?
Yeah,
sure. Nice to see you, Mathilde, from the Paris office of the European Council on Foreign Relations, to talk about the fact that leaders across the Western world, I imagine, Jasine, are breathing a sigh of relief this morning that they have Macron in the Elysee and not Marine Le Pen.
Yeah, that is for sure. And we already had this sigh of relief yesterday night. We also saw many leaders congratulating Macron. And when we were already speaking of the newspaper Le Monde, we even saw an op-ed published in Le Monde by the leader, by Scholz, Costa, and Sanchez, so leaders from Germany, Portugal, and Spain, who basically called for or called upon the French implicitly to vote for Macron. So there was it was absolutely clear that there was a clear preference for Macron in all the member states. And knowing that Macron will most likely continue his project on European sovereignty, it's clear that European integration is not in danger as it would have been with a Le Pen presidency.
Mathilde, from the European Council on Foreign Relations, how much preparation had there been for a Le Pen victory? I mean, were you strapping yourself in, ready for a crash?
Yeah, we were considering it, and I think for once it was actually a possibility, and it was quite frightening, I think, for people working on Europe and on foreign policy. But yes, I think for the first time there was a chance that it would happen. The polls just after the first round gave a really short gap between the two candidates. Yesterday we saw that the gap was even larger, but I think it was the Republican front that worked. But yes, I think for the first time there was a real possibility. In 2017, I think everyone kind of knew that he was going to be elected, but this time around there was a real real fear.
Well, staying with us on Monocle 24, we'll be talking a little bit more about Emmanuel Macron's future in the international stage in just a moment. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
8:21 here in Paris. I'm delighted to say there's a busy table here at Bonjour Jacob, the cafe in the 10th arrondissement. I'm joined by Gilles Paris from Le Monde. I'm also joined by Gisine Weber from the German Marshall Fund of the US and Mathilde Sula from the Paris office of the European Council on Foreign Relations. And I can hear some milk being frothed in the background. This is a wonderful, busy working cafe. Gisine, what does this mean now for Germany's relationship with France, given the fact that we've had so much focus in the past few years on Macron's personal relationship with Angela Merkel? I mean, the fondness between two highly technical beings was absolutely obvious to see. What does this now mean for the likes of Olaf Scholz within Germany, and what they can do in order to sort of like bolster their presence within Europe? Because it looks like Emmanuel Macron might be making a grab for the presidency of Europe in sort of were that to exist.
First of all, the most important thing for Germany to do is to give an answer to France. And that is exactly what Germany did not do in 2017.
What does that mean?
Because even if Merkel and Macron were always perceived as closely working together, which was also the case, of course, we have never seen the big political answer and a kind of German vision as a response to Macron's project. In 2017, in his Sorbonne speech, Macron had laid out his entire project for Europe, for the EU, and he had made several steps to take Germany on board for a French-German leadership on many of these big challenges to be tackled, such as security and defense. But the German answer was always very hesitant. And Germany didn't even answer with kind of a big European project to show where there are convergences between Germany and France and also divergences. So the most important thing, if Germany wants to play a role in Europe and wants to have a positive benefit from this momentum that we now see for Europe with Macron's re-election, Germany has to put its priorities on the table and has to formulate a clear answer to Macron and also think about the inclusion of other partners, for instance, like Spain and Italy in the south. We also see that Italy is becoming more and more involved, but also, and most importantly in the current geopolitical context, about Poland, even though that is extremely difficult sometimes to reconcile French and Polish priorities on security.
And in that context, it allows Mathilde, Emmanuel Macron, to almost fill a vacuum left in terms of leadership figures. Macron, it has been widely observed, is far more popular abroad than he is in his own country. What does that mean for the rest of the world to have this incredibly young, only 44, dynamic, youthful leader pushing an agenda of reform, but also trying to handle international crises, ringing up Vladimir Putin, going and sitting at the end of the massive table with him, trying to sort things out?
At ECFR, we did a poll back in January and February about European views on French leadership. And we asked questions about sovereignty, which is, you know, this idea that Macron pushed since 2017. And we found that, as you were saying, this idea percolated more with Europeans than with French people. And we found that Europeans trusted French leadership and Macron's leadership on European initiatives. So yes, I think he is going to double down on his sovereignty and pro-European agenda. And I think the war in Ukraine, as you were saying, the war in Ukraine and the leadership that he took since the beginning of it showed that he really wants to be this leader. But as Gesine was saying, I think we really... French people really need to understand that they need to work with other countries. They need to build coalitions, which is not something that they're really good at. But I think, honestly, Macron and his team have been trying to do it in the past few years, a bit more than the usual. And I think the Quirinal Treaty, for example, signed with Italy at the end of 2021, the rapprochement that has been also with the Netherlands in 2021 is also a proof that Macron is trying to do this. But yes, to be able to face all of the challenges and the geopolitical challenges, Emmanuel Macron and his team will have to really build coalitions and work with other partners while leading, I think, because there's no other state that have been really up to the task of leading, and no one has actually been proposing any alternative plan to Macron's. So I think France will have to lead if it wants its view of European sovereignty to evolve.
Gilles, let's bring you back in. Having worked in Washington for several years, you will probably be no stranger to seeing electoral upset. How much of a relief is Emmanuel Macron's second term going to be for the White House? And also, what does this now mean for relationships with the US and France and Europe? Given the fact that Europe had to stand on its own feet and fend for itself during the Trump era, and now there's a very strong voice second term in France.
Yes, but we still don't know what will happen in the US in 3 years from now, a little bit less. So, of course, it's a big relief for Washington, especially because a victory of Marine Le Pen would have ended a huge advantage to Vladimir Putin in his fight in Ukraine, of course. And it would have been also a huge setback on the vision of Biden, which divide the world in the democracies and authoritarian illiberal regimes. So it's good news for Washington, but again the Europeans have learned that everything can happen in an American presidential election, and we still have to wait for what will happen in 2024.
Let's hope, Gilles. let's cross our fingers. And going back to you, Josine, the idea, you know, there's obviously still uncertainty in the United States about taking a populist view again. Last night, many people were saying, well, look, this is the first time for quite a long time that populism can and must be defeated. This is a good day in that fight. We've seen Brexit, we've seen Trump. The French avoided that particular path, dare I say it. But what does it mean now when it comes to the sort of like the scope of Europe and international relations, when you do have populism being defeated? I mean, you mentioned a moment ago Poland being a problem and Hungary also being a big problem within Europe.
So first of all, I would come back to this idea of populism being defeated. Of course, we see that Emmanuel Macron has won and that the right-wing populist Le Pen has lost. But we have to consider, or we have to bear in mind, that still 2 out of 5 French people voted for a right-wing populist candidate, and that populism will not go away. And that will also be an absolutely crucial factor for European leaders to take into account when they are making policy on the European level.
And not
No, go ahead, please.
No, carry on, please.
On the one hand, that does, of course, concern everything related to European integration, policies like internal market, but also, for example, external border management. But when we're talking about Europe on the global scene, the spillovers there from populism are still limited, also because You know that we have legislative elections here in France where we might also see a strong right-wing bloc in the parliament. But on the other hand, foreign policy is pretty much something that is managed by heads of state and government.
Quick word to you, Gilles, before we have to leave this for the moment. There goes the coffee grinder. You have written in the past that we've just had the second round of elections, but now we have the third to go. We have a big thing happening in June, don't we, when Macron actually has to form a working government in France.
Yeah, there is still the feeling that in France there is a rationality for voters who usually give a majority to the president elected. So we will know in 2 months from now if it's still the case. I would like to add that we have not only a populist trend on the right side, but also on the left side. And if we look back to the first round, we have to remember that a clear majority of voters, the one who backed Jean-Luc Mélenchon, Marine Le Pen, Éric Zemmour, and some others, backed an opposition to the European Union. And we had yesterday a clear victory for what appears to the feeling that the European Union is now on a strong footing, but still it's very fragile. And we will see at the legislative election if Macron is able to build this majority and to have a coalition.
Gilles Paris from Le Monde, Jasine Weber and Mathilde Chissula, thank you so much for joining us around the table here at Bonjour Jacob. The time here in Paris is 8:31. We'll be continuing our coverage of the French presidential elections in just a moment. But first, a quick summary of some of the other headlines today. The US has confirmed that Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin traveled to Kyiv to meet Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky on Sunday. A Ukrainian official earlier said Mr. Blinken was in Ukraine, but the US had refused to comment. The US has pledged more than $7 million US in military financing to help the war effort. Myanmar's deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi is expected to face up to 15 years in prison today when a court delivers a verdict in the first corruption case against her. She's been charged with offences ranging from incitement and bribery to violations of electoral and state secrets laws. She's unlikely to ever make a political comeback. And an inquiry has begun into what caused a Japanese tour boat to disappear off the nation's coast, killing 11 people. The Kazoo 1 was on a three-hour sightseeing voyage around the Shiretoko Peninsula, an area designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. This is a Globalist. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Bonjour Jacob in the 10th arrondissement here in Paris, looking at a very quiet morning after quite a quiet evening, a very subdued second round victory for Emmanuel Macron. Walking through the streets last night, we'll have Marcus Hippie, my colleague, with me in a moment to talk about what it felt like down at the Champ de Mars in a moment. But look, let's look ahead to the next few years. We've already talked a little bit about Emmanuel Macron's international role, but let's hear about his role within Europe and also transatlantic as well. Georgina Wright is a senior fellow and director of the Institute Montaigne's Europe programme. Welcome, Georgina. Lovely to have you with us.
So lovely to be here.
So, how was it for you last night?
For the past sort of couple of months, I mean, I moved to Paris about a year and a half ago, so I was very excited about this French election. You know that campaigns are big, and I thought, gosh, I'm going to live through it. And actually, it felt a little bit like a dud. There was no real campaign, no people really mobilising. I'm generalising slightly, but last night you did feel a sense of excitement and nervousness. I thought, oh yes, they do know that this is quite a momentous vote. And then of course the results came out shortly after 8, and that's it really. And I've been following it ever since, seeing what Marine Le Pen was saying and Macron and also the other candidates who ran in the first round.
It's funny you mentioned that sort of sense of excitement. Just talking to Hanny, the lovely man who's welcomed us into Bonjour Jacob for the last couple of days and let us take over his magazine section, make it impossible for anyone really to buy anything because we're massively in the way. Sorry, apologies, Hanny. He's smiling at us. He said last night that this was the first time ever he'd actually made a date with the television at 8 p.m. to find out what was going on. Mm. There was a buzz in the streets last night in the lead up to it, and then everything sort of like dissipated quite quickly. Mm. But what's the general feeling when it comes now to the way that France is going to position itself Let's move now to international relations and the way that France is going to position itself in Europe. Because when you watched Emmanuel Macron walk to his platform at the Champ de Mars last night, he did it again. He did it the same thing as he did in 2017. There's a European flag. There is Ode to Joy. And I looked there and I thought, oh, hello, here's President of Europe.
I mean, I don't know how he'd feel about that. Probably he'd sort of smile. But there is a realisation, you know, for Macron and his team that actually if they want to achieve anything in Europe, they need to get other EU countries on board and the other EU institutions as well. It really is teamwork. But there is a sense that Macron is the only one to have lots of ideas about how to shape Europe, how to make it more sovereign, how to make it more powerful, how to make it more able to respond to crisis in its neighbourhood. And, you know, I was really struck by a couple of weeks ago. It felt to me that most EU governments hadn't really prepared for a Marine Le Pen victory because the polls were suggesting that Macron would win it easily. And then sort of when the polls started to narrow, there was this sense of, oh my goodness, we need to prepare because it would look fundamentally different. So to answer your question, you know, he will continue. He's going to want to go much further and faster than he has over the past 5 years. But if you think back to 2017, you know, he made this huge speech in a French university, again, with EU flags and young people, over 60 proposals about how to shape the EU. He's achieved some of those, but not all of them, so I can expect that he's just going to want to go much faster.
When you mean that, what can you see him doing in the next 5 years? Because a lot of people still scratch their heads slightly about knowing what Macron's strategy is. I mean, the Swedish, I think it's been mentioned, Marcus Hippie will bring this in a few minutes' time, have commented on how they don't actually know what Emmanuel Macron stands for, what he's going to do. He's really good at managing issues, but that great vision for France is still slightly blurred.
So I think there's a great vision for France, and then there's a great vision, like Macron's vision for Europe. And actually, if you look at what's happened over the past 5 years, all the initiatives that the EU have taken have had French fingerprints all over them. Right. So look at what they've done on tackling digital, huge digital platforms and trying to make the digital market more, you know, fairer for European companies. So that's one big one that we all talk about without realising that actually France has really been pushing for it. He's done a lot on French tech that he wants to sort of Europeanise, to have, you know, mass investment for European tech. So that's one area. On climate, he's been criticised domestically for not doing enough. But actually, if you look at what the EU's doing, it's now negotiating, you know, carbon taxes at the borders. It's talking about trying to have more ambitious decarbonisation targets. That's all France as well that's been very heavily pushing. And then you've got this whole question of defence, which a couple of years ago, everyone was just, you know, eye rolling. Oh, my goodness. Here they are again talking about European defence. But actually, we've moved on from that. We have the EU, you know, sending money, deciding to support Ukraine politically, militarily, financially, and also now talking about capacity building. I mean, there is a lot of things happening, but what could be different? I think he's now not going to be afraid to touch those really sensitive topics, which is one, the Eurozone reform. So France believes that how the euro is operating right now, there's too much emphasis on stability and not enough on growth. And so they want to change that. So perhaps revisit the deficit rule. Those are tricky issues because we know that Germany, but also northern countries are not very comfortable about changing those rules. So I suspect he'll push on that. And he'll also push on Schengen reform, which is a real concern for many French citizens. So they like freedom of movement, but they don't think it works. And they want to see stronger borders, so for the EU to have stronger borders, and also to be for EU countries to collectively manage migration flows. So that's going to be something he's going to push as well.
We do have to mention Brexit. I don't know why, but we do. So last night, Bruno Le Maire was asked if Emmanuel Macron will reset the relationship with Boris Johnson to restore some cordiale to the Entente. Not our priority, he said.
No, but I'm not surprised by that at all. I mean, honestly, being a token Brit in Paris over the past year has not always been very fun. You know, you've had the Brexit hangover. I was always of the view that there was going to be some need for a sort of a period of mourning almost before you could really reset the relationship. But then you had the AUKUS, you know, military pact, which came as a blow with Australia, the UK and the US. deciding to sell submarines to Australia, and then, you know, basically making the French-Australian deal dead. And so there were a real sense of just how are we going to repatch this relationship. But actually, you know, the UK is an important partner for France. It will always be an important partner, but it's not the priority. But that's not, you know, that's the typical French thing of saying, it's not because we're saying it's not a priority that we don't care about it. It's just that we have other things that we need to do first.
Can we see Ukraine being something that brings people together?
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing like a geopolitical crisis to focus minds.
Good. I'm absolutely glad to hear that, simply for the simple reason that it is one of those things that the United Kingdom has been liking to take the lead with this, or saying that it is taking the lead. But it is one of those things that NATO could bring people back into a fold that for all the wrong reasons, unites people.
I mean, I think it's quite interesting to see how the NATO conversation has evolved in Paris. I mean, around the AUKUS deal, again, this submarine pact between Australia, the US and the UK, there were people round the dinner table who were saying, what's the point of being part of NATO if allies treat each other that way? And there was a real questioning around the dinner table of the relevance of NATO and whether France should still remain a part of it. That has changed since Ukraine. And actually what you're seeing, and it's the French government, but also actually amongst the population, a sense that the EU must do more, but it must only fill the holes that NATO can't do. And so, in a sense, NATO could bring them together, but NATO cannot replace the EU. You know, it's a military, it's a collective defence and military alliance. It doesn't do everything else. And so, in that sense, there will naturally be, you know, France and Germany will cooperate much more closely, I think, than France and the UK will, simply because they're both members of the EU and they're part of a common market, et cetera, et cetera.
Georgina Wright, Senior Fellow and Director of the Institut Montaigne's Europe programme. Thank you so much for the moment for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist live from Bourgeois Jacob in the 10th arrondissement of Paris. Stay with us.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
$14.42 in Hong Kong, $8.42 in Zurich, $8.42 in Paris, which is where we're now going to have a quick look at the papers. I've got two people to do papers with me this morning. Aren't I lucky? Georgina Wright is staying with us to have a look at what the French papers are saying. Thank you, Georgina.
No, I'm delighted to be here.
Lovely to have you with us. And also our producer and presenter, Marcus Hippie, has been here looking at what
good
the
rest... Good morning, lovely as always.
Good morning, lovely as always. Marcus, just very quickly, you and I... We went out last night, didn't we? We went down to see the Eiffel Tower together.
Exactly, we did. We did also to go and see people celebrating Macron's re-election. It was quite a party. I was quite impressed. I don't think there are many things more French than listening to Daft Punk in front of the Eiffel Tower.
Now, that's gone bananas on the internet, hasn't it? Because people have said they have taken this wonderful, important place, the Champ de Mars, and they turned it into a nightclub with that... What was the DJ called? We were quite
Vanity.
Yes. Now, does anyone know who DJ Vanity is?
No,
from?
I'm showing my age here. I've no idea.
I don't think anybody knew who it was anyway. I don't think we're worried. So it was quite good fun, but we struggled, didn't we, to find somewhere to eat afterwards. I mean, the monocle tummy does need to be fed and refueled.
Absolutely. Well, luckily, we were quite lucky. We found a place to have food and we had these tremendous, huge pizzas.
It was quite easy to fall asleep after that. And the man who served us basically said that he'd expected a big run on pizzas that night, but actually everybody had gone home really early. That there wasn't the great party in the street that they were all expecting. Georgina, would you agree that it was... It felt really subdued in the streets of Paris last night.
Yeah, no, it did. But I think for lots of people, it felt very much like a rerun of 2017. So, you know, yes, most people in Paris, I was looking this morning at results, voted for Macron. There's a clear sense that they're probably happy-ish with the result. But for lots of people, you know, about a year ago, you really saw in polls that people were like, please, please don't make it a run for 2017. And also, I think Macron hasn't really... He's defended his first mandate. He obviously criticised Marine Le Pen's proposals, but he hasn't really said what he's going to do differently in the second mandate. So,
how's that being reflected in the French papers this morning? There's lots of sort of hooray, but oh, we have big challenges. That the, you know, the Figaro basically says a victory, but challenges ahead. And you have Les Echos in front of you.
Yeah, so I'm looking at the French papers now, and actually a common thread throughout all of them, whether it's Le Figaro and Les Echos on the right or Libération on the left, is this sense of, what is it that you're going to do now? So it's like a new beginning. It's, you know, a big victory. Of course, it is worth remembering that he's the only French president to win a second term without a cohabitation, i.e., you know, basically in the early 2000s, they introduced new rules where they reduced the presidential term from 7 to 5 years and then made sure that the parliamentary elections happened the same year. Well, since that point, no president has ever managed to secure a second term. So this is quite momentous. But there are lots of questions on all of them which say, what is he going to do now?
Can I just point out, I've been looking at international papers, and it's interesting how they are reflecting this situation and what you were just saying about these papers trying to figure out what Macron is doing now. It's quite well reflected, for example, in Sweden's Dagens Nyheter newspaper, that is, first of all, writing that Emmanuel Macron's victory in the French presidential election will make him now one of the great French presidents of modern times. But at the same time, quite a funny point. This victory also will give Sweden another 5 years to try to figure out what Macron is actually trying to achieve.
Yeah, we were discussing this. I mean, I think actually the really surprising thing for me is Macron is a great communicator in French to his own, but he's not always very good at communicating what he's trying to do internationally. And there's lots of ambiguity. You know, he makes an announcement in front of the European Parliament, and then you have all these people, including myself, like experts, trying to try, no, that's not what he meant, actually. This is what he meant. And it's a little bit more nuanced. So he's going to have to get better, I think, at just spelling out very clearly what he's trying to do. But the other thing with Macron is he's so ambitious. He has so many proposals. You know, it's not just like two or three things I want to achieve. Here are 150 things that I want to achieve. But actually, it makes it really fun for people like me who get to analyse what he does every single day.
A boring moment. And what else is on the front pages? You were mentioning something about digital law. No.
Yes, so that's in Les Echos Economy, Le Figaro Economy, where they talk about Europe now adopting a new digital law, which is, of course, this Digital Services Act, which will do all sorts of things to make sure that digital platforms are safer. And this was a very important priority for France. France, you know, for those who don't know, has the presidency of the councils. That's a grouping of the 27 member states in the EU for 6 months, and they're pushing lots of initiatives, and this was a really important one. So again, going to the heart of some of the things that France is trying to achieve in Europe. But I think the Libération on the left wing newspaper is also quite interesting, saying, you know, Large, he is the victor, but he owes his success to the fact that many French people have mobilised to make sure that the far right never gets into power. So again, he owes people, so what is he going to do?
It was the barrage he was talking about last night in his election speech. Marcus, what was it that you were going to add about the way that the rest of the world is covering the papers this morning?
Well, if we look at some other stories the rest of the world is covering at the moment, I was mentioning Dagens Nyheter already. It's interesting that one of the big pieces they have on today's edition of the paper is an interview with Anders Tegnell, who became famous as the state epidemiologist in Sweden. Obviously, the world was following Sweden's different approach in trying to deal with the COVID pandemic. And actually, Anders Tegnell has left his job about 6 weeks ago, and he's giving kind of a farewell interview for this newspaper. And obviously, they're discussing many themes and also lessons Sweden has learned from the pandemic. And what Tegnell is saying is that one of the biggest challenges that Sweden understood during the pandemic is that it can't just be one single health agency in charge of everything. Instead, it has to be kind of a common effort across all the parts of the society. And obviously, when he's looking at what should have been done better. He doesn't, you know, obviously he's been criticized for many, many deaths in Sweden, but at the same time, he doesn't agree that it would have been the state health agency's problem. More it was about a matter of like how well these different parts of the society were communicating together and working together in order to fight against the pandemic. Interesting interview over there. Some other stories then, looking at these papers, my home country, Finland, NATO discussion continues. And that's another story, obviously, besides Macron's election victory that's making headlines over there now. And what's interesting is that it seems very clear that Finland is joining NATO, and it looks very likely that Sweden will follow. And at the moment, why I'm saying that is that no major political players have actually stood up against NATO membership so far, but there is one MP from the Left Party who has said that she doesn't support joining NATO. And now the country's biggest newspaper, Helsingin Sanomat, has interviewed her and asked her to explain her thoughts. And there are some interesting arguments. It's always good to think about those. First of all, she's saying that NATO member countries don't always share the same values with Finland. She seems to think that the US, Turkey and Hungary, for example, are different nations and don't share that much with Finland. Also, she doesn't believe, Anna Kontula is, by the way, name of this MP, she doesn't believe that Russia is necessarily going to be a threat in the future. She's reminding that Putin is already in his 70s and, you know, he's not going to be sticking around for much longer.
Has someone had a word with her?
I know. I think she sounds a bit unreasonably optimistic about the future. But in any case, she says that the Putin era can't last for very, very long. So she thinks that Russia may well be headed to another direction. Interesting. Nevertheless, hearing someone standing up against the idea of joining NATO.
What I found really interesting last night when we were over our rapid pizza, our emergency pizza, we started talking about NATO in Finland, and that customary brevity that you occasionally have, that lovely, delicious Finnishness that you have, Marcus. I said, so what do you think about what's going to happen with NATO in Finland? And he went, oh yeah, they're just going to join. Should we get some wine? And it was just that sort of done deal. I mean, Georgina, there is a kind of done deal element with all this, isn't there?
I mean, ultimately, I guess it's a decision not only for government, but also how the country feels, right? But there's a real sense when you're in Finland. I was there just a couple of months ago. I mean, you are right next to Russia. There is, you know, geography matters.
You know, we are so used to it.
Yeah.
We're so used to it. And I think it's also that people talk about this so much. We've been talking about it so much in recent weeks that it's becoming so clear that it's just the fact that we will join. And also another question you, Emma, asked is what Russia is going to do next and how come we're not more concerned? And the fact is that all the experts are saying that Russia can't be fighting in two fronts at the same time. So if there were to be a Russian aggression, I think they're too busy in Ukraine at the moment to be too aggressive towards Finland.
Just moving straight back to France and the issue of Ukraine and also COVID. I mean, it was funny, just before we came on air, I was talking to Gilles Paris from Le Monde and said it's almost as if we've forgotten that Emmanuel Macron had to get everybody through COVID as well. Mm. I mean, the challenges that he faces now in the next few years, Les Echos is absolutely laying it clear. Ukraine, inflation, COVID and the issue of pensions. Yeah. This is a huge job he has to do.
Yeah, it's a huge job, and he's going to have to surround himself by people he trusts, but also people he can delegate work to. You know, Macron is brilliant in many ways, but apparently not very good at always delegating power. And I think that if he wants to be on all these fronts, he's going to have to surround himself by excellent advisors, as he always does, but also by people who can carry out all the different things that he's going to have to be doing at the same time.
Georgina Wright, Marcus Hippie, thank you so much for bringing us the papers on The Globalist. You're live on Monocle 24. Finally today, Face à Face, Dana Thomas, author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes, and such a lovely regular voice on Monocle 24, comes in, joins us at Bonjour Jacob in the 10th arrondissement to bring us the fashion news. I can't tell you how nice it is to see you, Dana. Good morning.
Good morning. It's lovely to be here.
How's life?
It's all good. I've just started a new podcast called The Green Dream with Dana Thomas.
How
do
amazing.
Subscribe. It's all about all things sustainable.
Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it on Monocle 24 first. Tell us, what's happening in the world of fashion? I mean, have people been concerned with fashion while everybody's been going dizzy over Macron, or is this really something?
Well, fashion is certainly concerned with fashion. That's you know, its navel-gazing self. And some big things that actually happened, some sort of big movements. First, the CEO of Old Navy abruptly exited the company. And Old Navy in the Gap Group is the engine, or has been the engine, keeping that company afloat. And it is not doing so well either. So Gap is in a, which has been working on a turnaround plan for as long as I can remember, because it's really been in trouble for like a while, more than a decade, is now being told by analysts that it should consider going, get off the stock market completely, because its stock collapsed when the CEO left, and go private again and have the Fisher family and, you know, buy it back, which they can because they're wealthy as all get out.
Would that save it?
Well, I don't know if it would save it, but at least we wouldn't know all the vulnerabilities, and this therefore, you know, bruise its reputation.
Let's move on to LVMH. What's happening with LVMH? It's Bernard Arnault in particular, the man who doesn't need to leave just yet, despite his age.
That's exactly true. You know, it's funny. One of the debating points of the election was, should we raise the retirement age to 65 from 62? And everybody kept flip-flopping on it. Yes, no, yes, no, because it became such a sore spot. The French want to stop working at 62, except Bernard Arnault, who has just managed to raise his retirement age from 75 to 80. He's 73 years old, and he said, I'm still here, and I'm going to keep on going. And the family was there when he made the announcement in the Louvre, and he said, you know, we're going to keep on keeping on. And you could see the succession plan, you know, of all of his kids, who by in 7 years will be well into middle age, lined up, ready to take over the company. They're being trained, and he's making sure. So it's the irony of this, of course, is he took over all these family-run companies because he said families know nothing about how to run a global business. And then he's followed the same exact model. He's going to leave this business at 80 years old. Oh, and he bumped everyone out because they were old at 68 and 60 and 70. And he's staying till 80 and giving the whole thing over to his kids.
What's been the reaction to this?
Well, the company's been doing really, really well. He seems sort of omnipotent. You know what I mean.
In charge.
And sort of, you can't slay him. The guy's just, he's like Superman. He just doesn't go down. And he actually looks better today than he did 10 years ago. So, I don't know. He's got plans, and clearly this is what keeps him going. I sort of feel like he thinks he's the Warren Buffett of France, or the Rupert Murdoch in France, in that he's going to just keep on till he's probably 90.
I wonder what ambition lies behind that. Thank you for that.
Now, money.
Really? Just that. No other
just
reason.
That. He wants to be the richest man in the world again. He wants to out-earn Jeff Bezos. It's not going to be easy because Jeff Bezos is so far ahead, but he likes being the richest man in the world. And so until he gets that and holds it for more than 24 hours, he's going to keep working at it.
Brilliant. Gucci, tell us, we've got a little under a minute, Dana.
Gucci, you know, Gucci's very high fashion, and with their designer, Alessandro Michele, they're like kind of crazy, goofy fashion that you sort of scratch your head and go, I don't quite get this. Well, you know who gets it normally is the Chinese. That is supposed to be their big market, like all of luxury. But the Chinese have turned a little sour on Gucci. Sales did not meet their projections by a fair amount. And people are now wondering, in the business, analysts are saying, is Gucci in trouble? And does it need a change? Which is, you know, an unthought of thing to say even a year ago, because everyone thinks that guy's a god. But clearly, to the shareholders, not necessarily.
Dana Thomas, thank you so much for joining us in Bonjour Jacob, in the 10th arrondissement. And that's all we have for today's programme. Many thanks to all my guests, and also to our producers, Marcus Hippie, Charlie Filmer-Court and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our researchers were Lillian Fawcett and Samson Mbogo, and our studio manager was Desiree Bandley here in Paris, and Christy Evans back at Midori House in London. Monica will be back in Paris for our annual Quality of Life conference from the 2nd to the 4th of June. We'll be bringing together the world's boldest thinkers, industry leaders and cutting-edge creative talents for a conversation on the things that matters to us all. And if you're interested in that, you can find out more information at conference.monocle.com. But for now, after the headlines, there's more music on the way. The briefing is live at midday in London. I'll be back here in Paris to join the team there. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great week.